Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. We here at The Takeaway are fresh off three fantastic days broadcasting from Oklahoma City, where we heard from a lot of local residents and teachers, politicians, activists about the future of their city and state. Oklahoma also has the second largest Native American population in the country, second only to California. There are over 330,000 Native Americans in Oklahoma, with 38 federally recognized tribes. Those large numbers have not always translated to political power in the state, however. Where fights for oil and water have been largely dominated by business or U.S. government interests, often at the expense of tribes. But some of the larger tribes in Oklahoma are getting more prosperous now, and that means the power dynamic might be starting to shift. John Hockenberry sat down with Logan Layden earlier this week at KOSU in Oklahoma City. Logan is a reporter with State Impact Oklahoma, and they talked about how Native American tribes are getting their voices and their interests heard.
Well, I've seen it in my own lifetime. I'm 32 years old, and whenever I was a little kid, they had a lot less power than they did today. Today, the tribes in Oklahoma, particularly the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Osage, these larger tribes are a real political force. And that has come about for a few reasons. I think the advent of casino gambling here in Oklahoma had a lot to do with it. Certainly, the tribes have a lot more money than they used to because of that, but also some pretty strong leadership in the tribes themselves. And so they've grown in my own lifetime to be a real political force that you don't want to cross here in Oklahoma, whereas in the past, obviously, they were sort of rolled over by both the federal and the state government and not really given a lot of thought to.
So 30 years ago, there was this kind of chaotic relationship between the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs and whatever was going on the reservations or other lands. But casino gambling and the leadership that that wealth has produced has completely changed things. These are autonomous entities, and they have political missions of their own.
That's absolutely right. The Choctaw and Chickasaw nations in southeast Oklahoma, throughout the history of the state, that part of the state has been in very deep poverty. There's not a lot of jobs, not a whole lot of resources other than the water that's there, and it used to be mining and logging. But we've seen the tribes now become one of the biggest employers in that part of the state. They are very autonomous. They provide a lot of jobs. And that's created a lot of goodwill amongst the tribe members. You can talk, you know, by talking to members of the nations, you can just tell the kind of pride that they have now, whereas 20 or 30 years ago, they just weren't the same sort of political force. Today, they build roads. They have a chocolate factory. They obviously, in the tribal water fight that we had here in southeast Oklahoma that I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, decades ago, the state government would have given not a second thought to what the tribes thought about wanting to take water from that part of the state. But more recently, you just don't want to cross them. That's bad for you politically if you have the tribes against you.
Is there a partnership being born here in the sense that tribes are inclined to work with civic authorities like the city of Oklahoma City and produce a new kind of environmental regulations that shares land and water and mineral rights in a way that the federal government maybe should look at as a model?
Maybe so. This is a few years ago. Oklahoma City, where we're at right now here in the metro, they have a need for water in the future. They see that they're a growing city. They're going to need other sources of water. Well, they own water rights to some of the lakes in southeast Oklahoma in the Choctaw and Chickasaw nations. And so the city pretty reasonably said, we're going to build another pipeline and bring even more water than they already do from southeast Oklahoma to Oklahoma City. No problem. We own the water storage rights there. We get a permit through the state. No big deal. The tribes stepped in and said, no, this is our water. And they cite this treaty from the early 19th century, the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit Creek, that promised them the water in southeast Oklahoma forever. And so the tribes say, no, you can't just pump this water out of here. We have this treaty, and it's never been gone back on. It's never been reversed. So they sued the state and the city here, and it went to court. For 5 years, they negotiated over this water in southeast Oklahoma. And at the end of it, the tribes got a lot of what they wanted, which was a seat at the table. They're not necessarily wanting to hoard this water to themselves. They were just tired of being run over and having their resources taken out of that part of the state without consideration. So they were able to get a seat at the table now so that whenever water is potentially sold to Texas, which is another issue, North Texas wants southeast Oklahoma's water, they're going to be able to be involved in those negotiations. They're going to have to be talked to, and their concerns are going to be heard and an important part of those decisions now.
Is the culture of the native tribes in Oklahoma and the the general culture of the state more in tune with each other? Are they aware of each other? Is there more intermingling? Does everybody cheer for the Thunder?
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. And the tribes, as they've gained more leadership and influence, they've embraced their culture even more. If you go down to the Sulphur area, to the Chickasaw Nation, Choctaw Nation in southeast Oklahoma, because they have more money now, they're able to – they're building things, cultural, you know, museums, things like this. The state itself is very proud of its Native American influence and history now. I mean, you look as far as our license plates to see that, or our state flag. We are proud of our culture here in Oklahoma, and we are on the same page when it comes to pride in the state as well and our sports teams.
What's the collision that you worry most about, or that state officials and tribal officials worry about, as we think about perhaps climate change changing the water situation to the point where this is going to become a fight?
Well, and I don't want to give the wrong impression here that everybody is happy with this water agreement. There are certainly people in the tribes and even among the leadership that worry about what the impact of this agreement may be one day. We're talking about a couple of lakes in southeast Oklahoma, and most significantly Sardis Lake in southeast Oklahoma, which is very beautiful and a recreational hotspot and a great source of revenue for that part of the state. Well, Oklahoma City is going to have certain rights to that water now. They're going to be able to pump some of it up here. And there is a lot of concern. We just, within the last couple of years, came out of a five-year-long horrible drought here in Oklahoma. And what if that happens again? And what if it happens in eastern Oklahoma? And Oklahoma City needs this water. They're thirsty up here, but Sardis Lake is in a drought situation, and they take some of the water. Well, then you hurt the recreational aspects of that lake. Nobody's going to come out to a dry lake. And so there are provisions in the agreement that say that that's not supposed to happen. But again, it will only be tested when we do get that first big drought. Until then, we won't know exactly for sure how much both sides, you know, the tribes can trust Oklahoma City on this thing. We'll just have to see. But for now, everyone involved in the case says there are limits to how much water we can take in drought situations, and we're not going to drain the lake. But, you know, that will be tested when we get our first big drought.
Logan Layden is a reporter with State Impact Oklahoma. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Despite that large Native population in the state of Oklahoma, there are still huge gaps in access to health care for tribal members. And in a lot of places, care for diseases like diabetes and mental illness is inadequate. Alfreda Dunkeen is a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma, and she remembers what life was like in Oklahoma City in the 60s and 70s, when the closest health facility was over 80 miles away. Alfreda's parents and other members of their community started a health clinic in that area, and that turned her into an activist. Alfreda sat down with John Hockenberry this week in Oklahoma City, and she says that taking on a dual role gave her a radical approach to problem solving, helping satisfy the demand for health services in her community while educating people on why those disparities exist in the first place.
We had Community Action Program come in for dental work. We had some employment career educators, and this was in the 60s. We would have powwows to bring money in so that we could pay the water bill, the gas bill at the facility. That it was a diesel garage that we rented. And that little community became, well, the clinic became the American Indian Center.
Would you say a partnership with white culture and Indian culture in Oklahoma with someone like you as the governor would create prosperity for both groups, that working together creates prosperity for the entire state? How would that work?
Oh, I believe so. The American Indians in this state do not get the voice heard oftentimes with the state government. And whenever it comes with the state government, it also filters up to the federal government. And we're minus things. We're minus a lot of opportunities and resources, because it doesn't filter up. And that's one of those things I always wanted to change, is to get people educated, to let people know that we can do things just like anybody else can. But we having our American Indian culture, I think it would be, gosh, profoundly positive to have an American Indian in a state office, such as the governor.
What's your vision of that one people, America? And since we're living at a time when Americans are confronting their history in ways that they haven't really done in decades, how do you see things changing in the next quarter century?
I think that what we're going to have to positively strive with our kids and our grandkids is that we're all a good people, whatever color we are. We don't need to be the ones to stay divisive with the races. And that's been such a problem. It'll be a problem until someone changes it, until we can be one people, like President Trump says.
Does everyone believe that in the Indian community, or are you just the peaceful one?
I'm the peaceful one, actually. Even some of my siblings will say, well, white people did this and white people did that, and maybe we wouldn't be here like this now. But that's gone. You can't go back and change what's happened. You can go forward and make positive change, but you can't go back. You can have that little devil on your shoulder telling you where you came from, what you've been through, but that's not going to change the disparity in health or education or gaming. It's not going to change anything. It's just going to make a bitter person.
Do you see bitterness in the future of the people living on assigned lands in Oklahoma, or more of a sense of peace and accommodation?
In Oklahoma, I believe more peace and accommodation, because we are getting heard more, and it's taken half a century to get heard more. But as there are so many Indians in Oklahoma, we are pulling together, and we are sharing our knowledge and voices with the chiefs, the other tribes, and that's all a positive thing. That's a good positive for the future. And I'm so proud that I'm able to be half Seminole. It's almost to be half Seminole anymore, or half of any tribe, is like a dinosaur.
Alfreda Dunkeen is a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma. She's founder and CEO of the American Indians for Health Quality, and she spoke with John Hockenberry this week in Oklahoma City.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.